Concordia Seminary Lyceum presents A Week of Impact in Systematic Theology. This tape is by Professor Carl E. Broughton of the Lutheran School of Theology in Chicago. It is the first in a series of two lectures on new methods in systematic theology.
Gentlemen, I never would have written those words had I thought they would ever be used against me. And that's the trouble with writing letters. Before I begin to present to you what I've prepared, I want to tell you roughly what I'm going to try to do tonight and tomorrow night. An overall title could be The Horizon of the Future, as the reigning principle in systematic theology. First of all, then, I have 4 points. I'm going to deal with 2 of them tonight, 2 tomorrow night. My first point is going to argue that we need to begin again in theology, and the place to begin is at the end. Eschatology is the beginning of theology. My second point is that we must break ourselves free from certain alliances between theology and some fashionable types of philosophy. So my second point is beyond existentialism and language analysis philosophy. My third point calls for a new correlation between theology and the horizon of our contemporary culture, a correlation with the futuristic thrust in modern culture, a correlation with the philosophy of hope, a correlation with secular futurology. My fourth point will deal with the way, or the challenge, or the task of systematic theology as a hermeneutic, a method whereby we do as Wolfhard Pannenberg has said, we fuse the horizon of primitive Christianity with the horizon of modern culture in a new comprehensive horizon, which is the horizon of the future. And therefore, my overall theme, the horizon of the future as a reigning principle in systematic theology. In the long run, it may become evident that radical theology has been having a cathartic effect on the church and its theology. The death of God phase may have helped to force theology to find the new beginning. I am a partisan in this quest for a new way to start theology. Therefore, while I am unable to count myself, and I think there would be few others who would wish to number me among the radical theologians, I feel myself closer to them than I have yet dared to acknowledge. Their questions are always in my mind. Their answers are always challenging those I have been taught to prefer. I share with them some of the shock at witnessing the collapse of the going systems. Whether one cuts his theological eye teeth more on Barth, Bultmann, or Tillich, or someone else, the feeling is quite general that we can hardly go on the way we have been going. But how do we begin again? Where do we go from here? My own gamble, then, is to work in alliance with a new movement in modern theology, which tries to grasp the gravity of the issues which confront the church and its theology today. The new place to start in theology is at the end, eschatology. The rediscovery of the role of eschatology in the preaching of Jesus and of early Christianity has been one of the most important events of recent theological history. The findings of biblical theologians, however, have not always, perhaps only rarely, been taken seriously by systematic theologians, in spite of their paying lip service to Sola Scriptura. The main response of systematic theology to the rediscovery of eschatology has been to so redefine the eschatology in question that it has lost its futurity. Eschatology has been predominantly understood as the dimension of the eternal shining through the temporal in rather Platonic fashion. And so it is true what someone has said, that very soon in Christianity became a kind of Platonism for the masses. Now, this Platonizing of eschatology is not only true of the Continentals, who have operated under some version of dialectical or existentialist theology, but also of the Anglo-Saxons, who, following C.H. Dodd or someone similar, have accepted some form of a realized eschatology. Both in exegetical and systematic circles, the dimension of the future in biblical eschatology has been a source of embarrassment. This horror of the future is perhaps best understood as a sign of the degree to which modern theology, as a function of the church, has succumbed to the establishmentarian mentality that has crippled the Christian movement in modern times, the extent to which theology has become ideology, and thereby set it in opposition to the revolutionary forces at work to change the world. Revolutionary thinking is always oriented to the future. It does not accept the past or the status quo as the picture of the homeland and the happy days which all men seek in one way or other. It has been good form for futureless Christians to deride utopianism in the past generation. Little did they realize, or perhaps they did, that in chucking utopianism altogether, they lost their own eschatology, which looks to the future of God's final and fulfilling coming. It is this loss of eschatology which has precipitated that mood in theology which feels it has lost God. Hopelessness is godlessness because both are futurelessness. Hope is a word whose correlate is the future. As a questioning being, man is oriented in hope towards the future. The categories of hope and future are crucial in the new theology which begins with eschatology. For this reason, it is variously referred to as a theology of hope. I prefer to call it a theology of the future. Sometimes it is also referred to as a theology of promise. I prefer to call it a theology for revolution. What one cares to call it matters very little, except that every new movement finds its own slogans, its own alluring rhetoric. A theology that addresses the whole man should not be faulted for using rhetoric, provided that that does not blur the rationality of its vision. Especially when one's vision orients to the future, there is admittedly a need for reason, ratio, to apply the brakes and to give a careful account of the logic of the language of hope that prospects the future. We do not claim to be able to offer more than a little start toward such an account. Hope was the original impulse of theology, says Ernst Benz. Jürgen Moltmann states, there is therefore only one real problem in Christian theology, which its own object forces upon it, and which it in turn forces on mankind and on human thought, the problem of the future. Gerhard Sauter wrote his massive Habilitation Schrift on the theme of the future, Zukunft und Verheißung in contemporary theology and philosophy. Harvey Cox, in similar vein, has stated, the only future that theology has is to become the theology of the future. The theology of Wolfhard Pannenberg made the initial breakthrough toward the triumph of the future as a controlling thematic in an eschatological interpretation of universal history, embracing the totality of developing reality. Meanwhile, this futurist approach is making headway among Roman Catholic theologians, for example, the later essays of Karl Rahner, after he began to emerge out of his existentialist phase, Schillebeck's, and Johannes Metz. Metz lays down a challenge to Catholic theology, the transforming effect of which could carry far beyond anything imagined at Vatican II. Doing theology within the horizon of the future, he says, reveals the world as history. History as final history, faith as hope, and theology as eschatology. ecumenical and confessional, liturgical and missiological questions will all appear differently, and some will disappear within a framework of historical and eschatological thinking. The idea of doing theology as eschatology is not new. It has a familiar enough ring. From the start, the dialectical theologians, Barth and company, insisted that, and I quote from the Romans commentary, "Christianity that is not entirely and altogether eschatology has entirely and altogether nothing to do with Christ." End of quote. These dialectical theologians taught that eschatology cannot be confined to the last things which orthodoxy reserved for the concluding chapter of dogmatics. They said, eschatology permeates the whole of Christian faith. It is the dimension of the eternal breaking in from above into the present moment. For the early Bar, as for the later Tillich, the eschatology of the eternal now was dominant. The universal relevance of eschatology was gained, however, by a radical redefinition in which the horizon of the future disappeared into the depths of eternity, shimmering in the present moment. In the case of Barth, the future was absorbed into the nunc aeternitatis, manifest in the incarnate word. In Bultmann's case, the future was finally subjectivized into the futuricity of existence in the immediate present. The eschatological future became an existential stance. The future as the approaching front on which really new things are expected to happen was not the focus of faith during the period in which Barth's theology of the Word of God or Bultmann's charismatic theology of existence were most influential. They did not teach their disciples to love the future. Theology was eschatological, yes, but in terms of the dialectic between time and eternity, from above to below, but at the price of its futurity. A theology of the future today builds on the insight of dialectical theology that eschatology ought not stand at the end of a system of Christian doctrine. Eschatology is not that last stage sort of thing. But a theology of the future today goes beyond dialectical theology in exploring the full scope of the eschatological horizon of hope. Eschatology has been a favorite word in modern theology. But how to activate it without surrendering its future meaning remained an unsolved problem in dialectical and existentialist types of systematic theology. For how can one speak of the future when it has not yet happened? But then, are we really dealing with a primitive Christian message at all if we remain silent about the future of man? This doubt has often been suppressed by assurances and reassurances that all that matters, after all, is a realized eschatology. But can we expect, or can we accept, a wholly realized eschatology in this imperfect world of imperfect men? Is that really more credible to Christians than to Jews, who were promised they could expect more, much more, from the coming of the Messianic kingdom? Much more than Jesus of Nazareth ever achieved. Every theologian knows today about Albert Schweitzer's rediscovery of apocalyptic eschatology in the preaching of Jesus. For Schweitzer, it was precisely this eschatology which alienated Jesus from modern culture and kept him riveted to the worldview of the first century. Schweitzer doubted that one could get a contemporary Christ out of an apocalyptic Jesus. So he developed a philosophy of life for himself, totally free of any of that eschatology that motivated Jesus. Schweitzer protested against the unhistorical treatment of the Gospels by many of his contemporaries, who distilled from the Gospels a middle-class ethic for cultured Protestants, leaving behind as of no account the eschatological Christology that underlies it, that underlies the ethic. This unhistorical line is being revived today. And this serves some as their theology. Jesus of Nazareth is then lifted out of the eschatological fog of his time and recommended to our world as the man for others. We have the man for others Christology current in modern theology. Jesus is pictured as the man of faith, the man of freedom, of love, open to others, with an emulable style of existence. It is widely thought, how widely I don't know, but I know it is widely thought, that Christology can build directly on Jesus' way with others, on some ethical substratum laid bare by historical criticism. The apocalyptic eschatology in the preaching of Jesus is then either traced unsuccessfully to later churchly redactions or dismissed unscientifically as of marginal significance in Jesus himself. The impulse to modernize Jesus is still strong. And since modernity is supposedly open to ethics but allergic to apocalyptic, the pictures of Jesus are painted a la mode moderne. Jesus is now an existentialist gripped by the urgency of the moment, in agony about God knows not what. Now a civil rights leader demonstrating for the underdogs. The neglect of eschatology leads to arbitrary and superficial treatments of the historical Jesus. And Schweitzer was right after all. Doing theology as eschatology is a proposal then to take seriously the apocalyptic character of the kerygma of Jesus and to seek his uniqueness not outside of, but within the horizon of its expectations. The function of Jesus' proclamation of the imminent kingdom of God was not merely to announce the times of the essence, and you must now decide. It brings with it an understanding of reality as history, of the hope of man, and the future of the world. The decisive event within the horizon of apocalyptic hope, as the New Testament presents it, is the act of God in raising Jesus from the dead. Ernst Käsemann made an important step forward among the Bultmannians when he traced the beginnings of Christian theology precisely to apocalypticism. In his words, apocalypticism was the mother of all Christian theology. Apocalypticism was the mother of all Christian theology. Käsemann called into question the current attempts to deal with history ethically, either in existentialist Bultmannian or hermeneutical Abelingian circle. And so Käsemann turned against his closest allies in theology, Bultmann, Abeling, and Fuchs. This came as a blow to a possible unified front among Bultmann's disciples. But Käsemann himself stopped short of consistency. He resisted, in my opinion, his own better judgment when he pictured Jesus' own preaching as an island surrounded on all sides by apocalypticism. Backward into Judaism and forward into primitive Christianity, Jesus was an exception, Käsemann thinks, to the universal character of the apocalyptic worldview. What else is this but still another attempt to find a privileged sanctuary in history for Jesus, to establish his uniqueness negatively by finding something in him that cannot be explained from within his own historical situation? The historical attempts to find some small kernel of difference between Jesus and his environment are misguided if they imagine that Christology and Christian faith can be based on just such a difference. To locate the uniqueness of Jesus that way can only succeed eventually in lifting him out of history, reversing the movement of the incarnation from God to man. Even, perhaps especially, in view of Nicaea's true God and true man, Christian historians are delivered from the temptation to take from Jesus' humanity, which means his radical historicality, to build up his divinity. It is not only historically implausible, but theologically unnecessary to exempt Jesus from the apocalyptic framework of his epoch, within which his ministry was understood by himself, was enacted in late Judaism, and also interpreted in primitive Christianity. So Caseman was right with respect to the Apostle Paul. He said even after his conversion, after he became a Christian, the Apostle Paul was an apocalyptic thinker. So the problem for a systematic theology in close touch with biblical exegesis is not how to get around the apocalypticism in Jesus, but how to start with it and find within its horizon the decisive meaning of Jesus Christ for a contemporary understanding of the Christian faith. Here we can anticipate only the barest minimum of what this might mean. Jesus was a Jew who stood within the traditions of late Jewish eschatology. Jesus was a child of his age, a man of his time. The futuristic thrust was an essential element of it, which Jesus shared. Further, Jesus made the claim that the quality of one's relation to that future, that is the future of God's coming kingdom, is determined by one's relation to himself. But the futurity of this future was not exhausted in his earthly presence. There is no realized eschatology in the sense that the not yet of the future is wholly exhausted in the already of the present encounter with Jesus. The power of the future retained its own reality as future in the preaching of Jesus. Only the future could make clear whether God himself would vindicate what Bultmann calls, aptly I think, the implicit Christology in Jesus' self-understanding. The early church saw in the resurrection of Jesus just such a vindication. The resurrection of Jesus stands within the horizon of apocalypticism. The legitimacy of Jesus' own ministry, his word and his work, was confirmed in its light. So the attempt of some theologians today to mediate an encounter with the historical Jesus or the crucified Christ, first by going around the resurrection and then by pulling out the eschatology, may be apologetically motivated as a way of trimming the Christian sails for our time. But in my view, the result lames the Christian witness and is found by the secular man of today not really worth a bother to disconfirm. I'm saying that it is the secular man precisely who cannot understand and doesn't want to have anything to do, doesn't even want to enter into dialogue with such a Christianity that reduces itself merely to contemporaneity. The loss of confidence in what is historically known to be central in the Christian faith has reached an all-time low in the history of theology. Not seldom do I find a theologian striding forth with a false comfort that the resurrection of Jesus is not at the heart of the Christian faith, but only a secondary interpretation, a product of reflection to advance the cause of Jesus after his death. Then we ask, what does the word God mean under such conditions? What if the Christian definition of God in his unity with Jesus is absolutely bound up with a victory over death in the resurrection? What if it's that that we mean when we use the word God? May it not then appear that the death of God phase in theology, as an inner theological phenomenon, which we have witnessed, is of a piece, can be understood only as the result of the dehistorization of the resurrection and the defuturization of the eschatological horizon within which it occurred and within which alone it has meaning as an answer to the question of man as a hoping creature. God reveals himself through what he has done. For Christian faith, the knowledge of God is eschatological. God is known as the one who raised Jesus from the dead. If you ask me who God is, I point to that event. He is the one who raised Jesus from the dead. I know no other God. Any other God is an idol for Christian faith. The resurrection is the eschatological event in which the end of the old creation and the beginning of the new creation are joined. On this basis, our language of God is filled with the eschatological vision of resurrection hope. In a literal sense, then, hopelessness is godlessness, because both are futurelessness. Hope is a word whose correlate is the future, I've said. The New Testament language of hope is oriented to the eschatological future of God, which comes already as an historical occurrence, though only proleptically, that is, provisionally and preliminarily, not finally, in the resurrection of Jesus of Nazareth. There is no realized eschatology. Hope, future, God, Jesus, eschatology, resurrection, these are all vocables with interlocking meanings in the interconnectedness of historical reality. To see these interconnections in a way that overbridges the history of revelation in the Bible and the conditions of modern understanding is the goal of a systematic theology that starts with eschatology. My second point, beyond existentialism and positivism, or post-positivistic language analysis philosophy, we are saying our own position is that the way ahead in theology is to take seriously eschatology as the originating factor and impulse in the Christian faith. Then, to interpret it in modern terms as the fulfillment of the future-oriented structure of human existence and of all historical reality. Many theologies which have been passionately concerned to establish a foothold for Christian faith in modern secular thought have been most oblivious to its passion for the future. Not only has theology thereby been unfaithful to its own eschatological origins, but it has dampened the interest of men who are in earnest about the future of mankind. When Karl Rahner, in a lecture before Marxist philosophers, explained Christianity as the religion of the absolute future, Roger Gaudaudy, the French Marxist philosopher, said, "Well, if you Christians begin to talk that language, we can understand what you mean." The Christian gospel can expect to get a hearing in modern culture only if it explores the revolutionary potential of the horizon of the future that is given in and with the advent of God in Jesus of Nazareth. The Christian gospel can expect to get a hearing in modern culture only if it has some important news to bring about our human future, if it is concerned about the world's tomorrow, if the Christian message has interesting things to say about the past, but has nothing important to say concerning man and the building of his future. Christianity is properly dismissed as deleterious, as irrelevant. Christianity must learn again, then, to take up the burdens of mankind for a better future, for a new future. Christianity is a revolutionary movement in history, or it is the movement of the Antichrist. There is a sting in the 11th and last of Marx's thesis on Feuerbach. And what he says of philosophers could be said of theologians. The philosophers have only interpreted the world in various ways. The point, however, is to change it. Ernst Bloch, who is a Marxist philosopher in Tübingen, has said that whatever is cannot be true. Whatever is there to be changed from the power of the advancing future. Talk about changing the world implies that we assume responsibility for the future. It is the responsibility of Christian hope. We have had creative theology in the modern era, but unfortunately, this creative theology has rapidly become sterile because it has struck up alliances with philosophies which black out the vision of the future and settled for an easy adjustment with the status quo. In recent time, two great attractions to theology have been existentialism and language analysis in its post-positivistic version. First, existentialism. Existentialism is a philosophy of the self. It seeks salvation in the inner freedom of man through Entweltlichung, that is, through detachment from the world. Existentialism is eschatological. Yes, it anticipates the future. The future is death. Death throws its dark shadows back upon the inner self, evoking despair, anxiety, fear. What else? Pointlessness, meaninglessness. There the self exists in the world. The world of other selves, of politics, of society, economics, there is the world, but there is nothing in it. Nothing in the world to confirm the outreach of the self for fulfillment. So the self is hurled back upon its own inner resources, only to gaze into the abyss of its own nothingness. There is no basis for hope, and the future means annihilation. Christian theology has tried to meet this desperate situation, saying, the existentialists are right, that's just the way things are. The existentialist has the right analysis of the human predicament, the right reading of the world reality. We Christians, we come along and we put Christ into the situation as an outside help, or the kerygma, or the word of God as a rescue agent. Ever since Immanuel Kant, theology has been placed in the dilemma of a split reality that is mirrored in existentialism. There's the objective world outside. That is the objectified field of modern science, which investigates nature and history as closed systems of cause and effect. Some theologians, and unfortunately many scientists too, continue to look upon the world as a fixed cosmos, running like an electric clock according to set laws. But Kant assured us that's not all there's to it. There's the subjective realm of the self, the interior realm of moral means and ends, of freedom, decision, the realm of practical reason, of obedience and responsibility, of duty. Theology saw a new opening for itself, for what it meant by the word God, what it meant by the gospel, in the transphenomenal dimension of subjectivity. Theology had the outside world closed to it, and so it went inside. Theology became interiorized piety. Theology since Kierkegaard became personalistic and existentialistic. The gospel was contracted to a message of individual salvation. This theology of existence, pietistic in its very origin, became isolated from society on the ground of the Lutheran Two Kingdom doctrine. Isolated from the world, isolated from the course of history. The inner changes called for in man to attain authentic selfhood had no effect on the world, on society, on politics, on the future of the world. Jaspers expresses the mood perfectly of his time when he speaks of the futility of inquiries concerning the future. Theology, which became locked in an embrace with existentialism, folded the biblical eschatological horizon of the future of the world as history into the existentialist personalistic horizon of futurity as a predicate of what he called Geschicklichkeit, the historicity of existence. That is to say, the promises of the gospel, which have a worldwide scope, a cosmic eschatology, were lavished on the individual as therapy for the soul's sickness unto death. Existentialism and theology's alliance with it must be seen as a retreat into the self, away from the objective world outside ruled by the inexorable laws of causality. Existentialism did not question that the world was just such a mechanism of determined facts and factors. Existentialism presupposed it, but only sought refuge from it in the interiority of the self. The solitary self did not hope to change the tyranny of scientific positivism and logical empiricism, but only to escape into an internal realm of personal freedom and meaning in the dimension of the I-thou. The Christian claims with respect to divine revelation and historical salvation had all to be made good within the dimension of subjectivity. The truth of this is in no wise diminished by a loud stress on the radical objectivity or subjecthood of God as the one who in his total otherness breaks in from the outside into the incommensurable sphere of humanity. For that is nothing more than a subjective claim, which moreover declares itself free of any responsibility to be tested in face of competing criteria and claims to truth. Christian theology was satisfied to become isolated, provided it could count on non-interference from other disciplines. You leave us alone, we'll leave you alone. Theology's answer to a positivism of science was a positivism of its own, what Dietrich Bonhoeffer, in accusing Karl Barth, called Offenbarungspositivismus, that is a positivism of revelation. For a while it appeared they could exist, coexist, even in the same heart and mind. Moltmann's judgment is apropos. He says, hence the result is, as for Kierkegaard, the alliance of a theoretic atheism and a believing heart. Bonhoeffer raised a protest against Barth's positivistic doctrine of revelation and provoked theology to seek a secular translation of the gospel. Bonhoeffer himself, however, did not offer a positive clue as to what might be meant by a non-religious interpretation of biblical concepts. What system of categories, what words or concepts or symbols would pass for being secular? Bonhoeffer did not look with favor on Bultmann's existentialist demythologizing, nor on Tillich's mystical ontologizing, nor on Barth's rechristenation of traditional dogmatic concepts. The attempt has been made since Bonhoeffer to turn Bonhoeffer's protest into a program and to find secular equivalents of the gospel free of its traditionally religious framework. And the death of God theology, to a large extent, at least in the case of Paul Van Buren and William Hamilton, is the attempt to make a program out of Bonhoeffer's protest. So we turn to another front on which theology has tried to establish a creative relationship with philosophy. The later work of Ludwig Wittgenstein in his philosophical investigations is currently being pushed as a promising philosophical ally for theology. I've just returned from a year in Oxford. I can say that this seems to be the attraction on the horizon for Anglo-Saxon theologians. This is called the philosophy of ordinary language analysis. It has the unquestionable merit of being able to claim contemporary relevance, for after all, was it not hatched from the incubator of scientific positivism? Wittgenstein's first important work, Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus, still stands as a major tract of positivism. If theology can succeed in making sense for itself within the framework of the philosophical movement that runs from the Tractatus, the early Wittgenstein, through the investigations, the later Wittgenstein, and beyond, it will have scored a victory. First, theology will have taken itself out of its solitary confinement. And secondly, it will have found for itself a distinguished partner in the modern world of secular thought. And this is what many theologians are trying to do, and therefore they look to Wittgensteinian or post-Wittgensteinian language analysis philosophy. Ordinary language philosophy can help theology to analyze the logic of its own linguistic heritage. So far, however, the world of language analysis has had a smothering effect on theology. I do not say it has to have that. I simply make it as an empirical judgment, right or wrong, that language analysis philosophy has had a smothering effect on theology. Rather than acting as midwife, it has served more as abortionist, bringing the baby out dead. Most theologians who have agreed to play by the rules of this linguistical game have behaved very badly, even when they have played brilliantly. It can be a boring game for theology to play, unless it turns to the analysis of extraordinary language, the visionary language of hope, the utopian language of revolutionaries, the Christian language of the future, the strange images of dreams, the imaginative figures of poetry. So far, this language, this futurist language, which transgresses against the ordinary world of words and things, has aroused little interest among the language analysts. They have little passion for the future. They have not found the philosophical incentive to delve into language that fastens on to the future, that goads the philosopher to criticize the actual present in light of his anticipations. So there has been a kind of alliance between a realized eschatology and this philosophy of ordinary language. As one philosopher is aptly charged, language analysis philosophy is a nursery for leaving the world exactly as it is. And so is realized eschatology, such a nursery. Too many theologians who have attended this nursery school use their linguistical and logical skills to justify the ordinary language of the Christian tradition, sometimes in the most hollow phrases of natural theology and the most static utterances of the Bible or the creeds. And so it is not uncommon for British theologians to use the analysis of language method of language philosophy to return them to the Christology of Athanasius, and there they remain. The philosophy of language analysis in its present mood can easily serve to confirm the theologian in the convictions he already has, leaving everything as it is, or they offer him an exit from the Christian faith with no difference to his philosophy. Examples could be given. The point, of course, is not to be made ad hominem, but to put a question to theologians who profess the metaphysical neutrality of ordinary language philosophy. The philosophers will get around to asking themselves the same question, as they usually do. The question is the one to which Herbert Marcuse devoted a chapter entitled The Triumph of Positive Thinking, One-Dimensional Philosophy, in his book One-Dimensional Man. In a way, Marcuse's book is a diatribe against Deutero-Wittgenstein, against the later Wittgenstein. And it is this Wittgensteinian philosophy which some theologians are hailing as though it were a revelation of providence. Marcuse's thesis runs something like this. Language analysis has not shed the positivistic attitude toward reality. Positivism is a passive acceptance of reality as it is, the given frame of reference, the ordinary use of language, the common modes of behavior. The great enemy is a revolutionary philosophy of change whose concepts are in transcendent tension with, even in contradiction to, the established world of speech and action. Analytic philosophy is an invention which suits the comfortable life of the Oxford Don, who takes the world as it is and can easily afford to do so. Linguistic analysis has an intrinsically ideological character. Its methods are self-effacing and humble before the established reality. It is a therapy to relieve the cramps of the mind induced by the great metaphysical questions about ultimate truth and ultimate reality. And thus it removes the only possible resources from which to contradict and to violate the established universe of discourse. The man in the street with his ordinary language, plain old Joe Doe, so full of common sense, yields the raw material for the analyst's language games. Marcuse, like many others, calls attention to how trivial the language under analysis can be. As he says, blown up atoms of language, silly scraps of speech that sound like baby talk, such as, "This looks to me now like a man eating poppies." He saw a robin. I had a hat. The reader of this philosophy and of the theology created after its image becomes bored at receiving so damn much clarity on such trivial subjects. Marcuse offers many examples, such as how much skill and space Wittgenstein in the theological investigation spent in analyzing the assertion, "My broom is in the corner." A systematic theology of the future must, of course, be interested in the analysis of language. Only, the language is not very ordinary. But more important than that, the aim of the analysis is revolutionary. The language is taken from the storehouse of promise, prophecy, apocalypse, from the prospects of hopes and visions, of utopians, futurists, and revolutionaries. Not that it need ignore the forms of language that correspond to the empirical facts of perception, to the existing state of things. But the goal of analysis is not simply clarity, to get clear and distinct ideas, or to create models of reality to describe what already has been or already is. Rather, the aim of analysis is to know what is in order to change it, to create new language, to fit new reality that new history brings in as the present reality is transgressed from the pressures and power of the future upon it. Whatever is cannot be true. The one who said, "There's nothing new under the sun," was not a wise man, but he was suffering from an optical illusion. Language has a proleptic structure, anticipating the truth of reality that is not yet, that is hoped for, perhaps something to be prayed for, as we pray, "Thy kingdom come," because it has not yet fully come, something to be awaited. Theology should welcome the new logical and linguistic means of analysis, of course, while challenging, however, all the neo-positivistic assumptions about language and reality in analytic philosophy. Whatever Wittgenstein might have meant in saying that, and of course this is why there are theologians who like this late Wittgensteinian philosophy. But Wittgenstein said that philosophy leaves everything as it is. And he said, every sentence in our language is in order as it is. I submit the face value of such statements can give the theologian false comfort and make him complacent within his own given tradition. For when the theologian transposes, he says, everything given in the tradition is okay as it is. We only need to analyze, to understand, to get clear and distinct ideas of what has been, of what already is. As if this ordinary world and our ordinary language are all we want them to be. As if they have arrived and history is finished. Language is complete and we have only to discern, to think clear and distinct ideas. What kind of a world does Wittgenstein imagine when he avers the problems are solved, he says, not by giving new information, but by arranging what we have always known. Why do theologians rejoice when philosophy announces philosophy may in no way interfere with the actual use of language? It is understandable, of course, that theology, which has been suffering from an inferiority complex in the face of the positivistic spirit of the age, it is understandable that theology would breathe slightly more easily in partnership with a philosophy which does not prohibit a priori the use of religious language, and which does not call it meaningless. But underlying this new tolerance in language philosophy is the one-dimensional thinking which infects a philosophy or a theology whose implicit ideology is satisfaction with a ready-made world of the establishment. When that ready-made world is the established church with its established doctrines, its traditional cant and cult and canon, its traditional liturgies, its traditional structures, theology is acting ideologically when it seeks out an alliance with this kind of a philosophy. For then this philosophy helps the established theology to keep things just the way they are. Modern theology, through its encounter with existentialism on the one side and positivism on the other, must press on to a conception of reality as a whole that overcomes the split between subjectivity and objectification, which has been inherited since Immanuel Kant. The two sides of this split universe can be overbridged only in a fluid conception of reality as history opening toward the future, the horizon of which is illuminated by the Christ event. It would be fatal for theology to imagine that it could survive by retreating into the sphere of subjectivity or by accommodating itself to the objectified world of words and things. The eschatological message of the Christian faith is concerned not merely with the private things of the soul, but with the public realities of the world and its future. The individual does not have a history of his own. The idea of the individual is an abstraction. Does not have a history of his own apart from the world. His life does not have a meaning of its own at odds with the world. He has a history and a meaning with a history and the meaning of all creatures, of all creation, samt allen Kreaturen, Luther said in the Small Catechism. The truth and the meaning of his history and the world's history are revealed only at the end when God shall be all in all. But already now, as Christians know and believe, that end has appeared, has arrived in a preliminary way, as the first fruits, not as the last fruits, as the first fruits, the Bible says. This is the initial inbreaking of the end in the history of Jesus Christ. And this is why all Christian theology may be said to be a messianic interpretation of history. This is why Christians should think of themselves as pilgrims on the way, en route, with a passion for the future of reality not yet finished. This by itself places Christians in tension with any mode of thinking, however dogmatically correct or pragmatically useful, any mode of thinking which takes this world as it is. The status quo is not what it is meant to be, no matter how good it seems. And it doesn't seem so good right now. The world is there to be changed. Christians pray, "Thy kingdom come," every day, many times a day, because their imaginations are filled with visions of new things, of new reality, of things which have not yet happened. In the present, we Christians may work to invalidate and to subvert the facts. We are subversive. We are revolutionaries. So that facts might become sign events beckoning the future of new reality struggling to be born in the present. The present world is loved for what it might become, not for what it is, for the sake of its future in the kingdom of God. Thank you.